Hi, everybody. I'm Ryan Milne. I am an alcoholic. And they asked me for like a reading from the book. I wasn't ready. Then I forgot about it. I had like 15 minutes to do it. I forgot about it. So I love that sentence on page 77. So it's kind of my go-to or whatever. I am psyched to be here. I am so grateful to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess don't get too excited. I'm pretty psyched to be anywhere. It's my nature. I'm an enthusiastic person, but I also understand alcoholism, and I understand the true, hopeless condition of mind and body. And I know where I came from, and I know where I am today. And, sometimes I know I can be a little much sometimes, but I am just so psyched. I'm glad to be alive. I'm free from the bondage of alcohol, man. How cool is that? I mean, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I work... I'm a truck driver, but I do the loading dock in the morning. We start at 5, and it's 5 a.m., so like 4:55, I'm kicking open the door. I'm like, let's go. God gave us another day. Let's go. And these guys I work with, like, can't take me. Like, dude, it's 5 in the morning. What are you talking about, what else do I got to say? Jeff, thank you for asking me. I really appreciate it. Depth and Weight Group is awesome. I listen to a lot of speaker talks, and your website is a great resource for me. I probably listen to a talk every day or something like that. So I listen to the talks on your site, and I'm just glad to be here. It's cool. I should tell you about my first phone call with Jeff. Actually, it's pretty funny. He asked me to come out and speak. I'm like, yeah, sounds great, whatever. Then he goes, listen, dude, I'm going to be honest with you. You're not my first choice. So I'm like, all right, Chris Raymer's booked that night or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. And he goes, really, you're not even my second choice. That guy didn't call back, But we ended up being good friends, and it's cool, man. Yeah. Oh, he did say something else hilarious. We have this long talk. We're talking about all the people we know, whatever, And then at the end, he goes, listen, this is a big deal. Can you, do a good job, please? And, a few things ran through my head, because I didn't really know him, And I've been in that position before where, I asked somebody to come be my home group's anniversary speaker that I didn't know was, on a recommendation. And I remember sitting there. I was the chairperson. I remember sitting there, during the readings, oh, God, I hope this guy doesn't bomb, I got it. Then my other thought was, should I tell him, I never try to suck, But of course, I give the spiritual answer. Well, Jeff, I asked God to speak through me. So if you're not happy with that, blah, 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 whatever. I will talk some about alcoholism. I spent some years. Did I say my sobriety date? November 13th, 2006. My home group is PPG Webster. We are a line-by-line book study on Zoom. If you want those numbers, come see me after the meeting. Really nerdy stuff. So it's not for everybody, but man, do I love it. I'm all in. I spent some years where I really wouldn't, I would just, I'm so enthused with our program of recovery that I would just, anytime I spoke, it would just be, talking steps and recovery and stuff like that. But lately, the last, 3 or 4 years, I've kind of been real passionate about talking about alcoholism. How can I say it in a nice way? It seems like a lot of our fellowship has a lack of understanding of what real, true alcoholism really is. And, it's a deadly illness. It's chronic, it's progressive, and it's fatal. And, we hear a lot of things in AA meetings that don't coincide with what alcoholism is, put the plug in the jug, just don't drink and go to a meeting, all that kind of stuff. My least favorite, absolute least favorite. I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody, but sometimes you'll hear somebody say, I woke up this morning and I chose not to drink. And I'm like, what are you doing here, man? Go live your life. You don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. Go choose not to drink. You don't need a spiritual solution. Go live your best life, I guess, our program spends a lot of time breaking down and explaining why we actually don't have a choice whether we're going to drink again. That's what the first step's really all about. when I first started drinking, and I don't use the word lightly, it was magical. When I started drinking, for real, it was a solution that I didn't know I was looking for that I had found. You know what I'm saying? I felt, I was always awkward and uncomfortable and I don't know how to say it. You know what I'm saying? I just always, anyways, when I started drinking, man, I was just like, this is what I've been looking for. And this, you know, the warm feeling that came over me, this like, just, I felt bonded. I felt connected to the people around me. It was the first time in my life that I actually felt truly connected to other people. You know, even in my family, like I come from a great household. My parents, I knew they loved me. I mean, it was obvious they loved me, but it's like there was something in me. I could never really feel that. You know, I was not blocked off from that, or you know, I don't know what it is. But that when we started drinking, man, it was just. And I loved it, you know, I love you, man, all that kind of stuff. Like all the camaraderie, I enjoyed it all. I was all in, you know? And, you know, what I didn't really recognize was, you know, I thought alcohol was affecting all these other people the same way it was affecting me. You know, it turns out they say something like 5 to 10% of the population's alcoholic. So that means, you know, most people that are drinking are not having the same effect, you know, alcohol's not affecting them in the way it is me. And, you know, how it affects me is I want more. I need more. And I could never really understand, you know, in high school, you know, it'd be like Friday night or something and, you know, maybe 11 or midnight or something. And these kids would be like, I got to go. I got basketball in the morning or I got to work in the morning or, you know, whatever it was. And I'm like, what are you talking about? We are just getting going. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm let's go, you know, alcohol wasn't doing for them what it was doing for me, you know. You know, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have an allergy to alcohol, that I have a, you know, a craving beyond my physical craving, beyond my mental control. But I didn't know that, you know, when you're a high school kid, you're just like, I thought I was having fun. I didn't want the party to end, you know? And, it just affected me different. I refer back to this dude. So I was in a band in the 90s, right? And this, the drummer of our band, so we used to have band practice twice a week. So the drummer of our band, my friend Corey, so we always used to get beers for practice. You know, we'd have beers. And I would watch this dude drink, right? And, like, he would always have a beer, you know, and we'd be playing. We're all drinking, you know. And sometimes he'd have a second beer. Without fail, somewhere in that second beer, maybe the beginning, the middle, or the end, he would legit push it away. And just be, I'm good, I'm done, you know. And I used to be fascinated by this, you know. And I would ask him, Corey, what do you mean? What do you mean you're done? You know, he said, oh, I'm good. You know, alcohol is a social lubricant. And he set out and he hit his target. He was comfortable. He didn't want to drink more. He used to tell me, I don't like that out of control feeling that I get when I drink too much. Oh, you know, when I drink too much. I don't like that out of control feeling. And it's just, that's how his wiring is, you know, shut it down. And for me, you know, almost at the same place, somewhere in that second or third drink, it's like this total opposite thing happens to me where, like, you know, my wiring says, let's go. It's on. What are we doing? You know what I'm saying? We're just getting started. And it's just this like total opposite reaction that I have to alcohol. And, you know, through that craving for more, you know, that's where the consequences came in. You know, I have lots of consequences from that. So, you know, it didn't take too long where I started seeing the consequences and seeing the drinking was causing some trouble in my life. And I'm talking like still in high school, you know. You know, minor consequences in the scheme of things, but still consequences. So I would tell myself things, and I was able to kind of control it and rein it in, especially in the early days. I could see, all right, you're getting too out of control. Like, you know, let's not drink all week. And when we drink on Friday night, we'll just have, you know, I'll call my numbers. You know, I just have, say, you know, four drinks or something like that. I've never said one. Like, that's dumb. You know what I'm saying? But I would, like, try to say, like, you know, four drinks, you know, and I was able to do that. There was a period of my life, of my drinking, that I was actually successfully able to do that, you know, but the problem was I wasn't having fun, you know, like that's not really what I wanted to do, and I would go home and just kind of be miserable, you know, and I was able to like control it a little bit, you know, but what would happen is my pattern would be that like as those weeks would go on, I would kind of just say, you know what, you know, this sucks. Let's just drink how you want to drink, you know? And then there's no control at all. But then, you know, I'm really, really enjoying myself and I'm really drinking how I want to drink. And, you know, and our book tells us, you know, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking. at the same time. And I was never, since the beginning, was I ever really able to do that, you know? So the consequences got worse, and people around me started saying things like, Ryan, you got to quit drinking. You got to stop drinking. You know, it's getting, and that seemed logical, right? Like, the drinking seemed to be where the problems were coming from. That made sense, okay? So I started agreeing with them, you know, my parents, family, significant other, you know, whatever it was. And I would say, yeah, the drinking, the judge, I would say, yeah, the drinking's getting me in trouble, you know, and I would stop. And, you know, to me, this is the real, you know, interesting aspect of alcoholism is, you know, I would stop drinking, and then I would start again. You know, and like as things got worse and it got towards the end, it was like I would make these firm resolutions not to drink again, you know, and I really, truly would mean it, you know. And I was always like a Mr. Quitting Forever. I was quitting forever. I'm done forever, you know, and forever was somewhere in between, you know, 4 hours and 2 weeks or something like that. You know, that was my forever. And, you know, I like to look back and think what would happen in my life, in my mind, in that time, in between that 4 hours and 2 weeks where I would start drinking again. And, you know, they didn't use the term back when this was written, but like, you know, it legit seems like a mental illness, you know, because I'm no longer, once I've detoxed, once the alcohol's out of my body, I'm completely sober. And I seem to, looks like a decision, but I start drinking again. And, you know, it seemed like alcohol was the problem. It felt like alcohol was the problem because of the consequences, you know? But what would happen is I would stop drinking and I would think the problems would go away. And they would, as far as like, you know, I wasn't catching charges, I wasn't getting in fights. Like that kind of stuff was like, you know, those kind of consequences were ending. But, you know, I was just so miserable. And, you know, I would just, you know, Silkworth says restless, irritable, and discontented, you know, and you know, just so full of anxiety and stress and just so tight and uncomfortable in my own skin. I just couldn't take it. I really just couldn't take it. So, you know, although it looked like alcohol was the problem, it turned out, you know, it was actually my solution. It was my solution to life. And, you know, I like to say, sometimes I say, well, I didn't really have a drinking problem. I had a sobriety problem or a life problem or something like that. But, you know, there was a drinking problem too. You know, I'll be clear on that, you know, but I don't want to just flat out say it wasn't a drinking problem. But, you know, the real crux of it all, you know, it's centered in my mind. I just couldn't stay quit. And, you know, it just becomes really, really, really hopeless. The two words I think describe alcoholism, they're my favorite right now. I mean, ask me in 2 weeks, it'd be something else. But like right now, my two favorite words that describe alcoholism is this time. Because I would use this time on both ends. When I was quitting forever, I would say, this time I mean it. You know, this time's going to be different until I do it again, you know. And the same thing, when I go out to drink again, this time's going to be different. This time I will, you know, no hard liquor this time, or, you know, wine only, or, you know, all these kind of combinations that I would try to do to manage my drinking, to manage my alcoholism, to not invoke that physical craving, you know, they failed every single time. And, you know, it just becomes absolute, you know, it's a real, real hopeless place to be, because it's this cycle of quitting forever, drinking again, passing through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, firm resolution not to drink again, and on it would go. you know, so I started going to, I'm skipping ahead some, you know, but I started going to AA meetings. And I started going to some AA meetings. And I had this, like, these different kind of reactions to AA meetings. One reaction was, I didn't feel like I belonged. I would come in, you know, I would have a hood on and earphones, and like I would just sit in the back and just kind of stare at my feet, and you know, I can see now I was full of fear, you know, but it felt to me that I didn't belong, because when you stop drinking and when I stop drinking, we don't feel the same. Because before the meeting, everyone's busting chops, laughing, having fun, talking about their jobs and their kids and their lives, you know, and I'm sitting back there just absolutely miserable, just like ready to punch the wall or something, or get hit by a bus, I guess. I didn't really feel like I belonged. But something else would happen. You know, the meeting would start, and somebody would share about their drinking, you know? And I was able to identify with, you know, their actual drinking and the feelings that they had, you know, while drinking and while trying to not drink. And I started feeling like I belong a little bit. But, you know, I kind of got some mixed signals, I guess, you know. They would tell me things like, think through the drink. Remember the worst before the first. Play the tape all the way through. And, you know, I would hear that stuff. And this is why it was so baffling and confusing for me, because I was able to do that for a while. You know, I would, you know, all those sayings kind of imply that I'm going to use my mind to keep myself sober forever. It's this idea of like staying on guard, okay? And I really, truly didn't want to drink anymore. I was really, really down and out, and you know, life was just about over. So it was this idea that I would hear in some AA meetings that, you know, it was basically keep on guard, remember the worst before the first. So what it would look like in real life was, you know, I'd be on the bus heading to a meeting. I'd say, man, I want to drink. Nope, you're sober now. You're not drinking. Nope. And then 4 minutes later, man, a drink would feel so good right now. Nope, you're sober. You're doing AA now, man. You're not drinking anymore. And an hour later, you know, screw this AA thing. You should go drink. Nope, I'm not drinking now. And I was able to do that successfully, you know, 99 out of 100 times. But, you know, the insanity of that first drink, the desperate experiment of that first drink would happen, you know, eventually. It always does. It always did. The time would come where I would just, you know, unable to pull into my consciousness the suffering and humiliation of even a few weeks or a month ago. And I would just blank that out. I would just forget it. I would just, it just wouldn't be there, you know? And, you know, the book talks about, I lack the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. I love that reference because, you know, that's embarrassing to say. All right, we had this cottage when I was growing up, and we used to have these bonfires, right? And we used to take these glass bottles and put them in the bonfire in the coals and let them, then in the morning you go get the bottle and it'd be like all melted and cool looking, you know? For one reason or another, I was like 10 or, I don't know how old I was. We're sitting there at the fire, you know, I reached in and grabbed a bottle. I don't know why, I don't know what I was thinking, but I really burned myself bad, burned my thumb really bad. It hurt a lot. For like a few days, you know. And let me tell you, I'm really safe around bonfires and campfires till this day, 45 years old. Like, I'm really safe around the fire. I keep the kids back, you know what I'm saying? Like, my brain remembers the pain from all those years ago, 35 years ago. My brain remembers the pain that came from grabbing that bottle. But not so with alcohol. It's like, I just, you know, it's a strange insanity, you know, where I would just not be able to bring that into recall. And, you know, that is my story. I'm like the relapse king. I had, we used to joke. I mean, I had like this shoebox, legit, with these 24-hour coins and 30-day coins, a couple 60-day coins, you know, like that's what it looked like because I was on this. That's what I was doing. I was using these like AA slogans to try to keep myself sober. Now, I'm not banging on the fellowship, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not really what I'm doing here, because in every meeting, they read AA's program of recovery, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it seems to not, it didn't really make sense to me. It didn't seem rational. It's like, I didn't have a problem with the 12 steps. I didn't have a problem with God or a man. I didn't really have a problem with any of it. It just didn't seem to be able to help me right now with the problems I have at this moment. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sitting there just like rocking back and forth, absolutely miserable. And like, I'm trying to figure out how to get cigarettes. You know what I'm saying? And you're talking about like, came to believe, like all this stuff. And I'm just like, It didn't compute to me how that was going to be the solution to my problems. You know, it didn't really make sense to me. It seemed like something nice I might do someday. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wasn't against the steps. It sounds like, let me get my act together a little bit. Let me feel a little better. And then I'll worry about these 12 steps you guys keep telling me about, you know? It was like the kind of mentality of like, you know, maybe I'll do the steps someday. Maybe I'll like take guitar lessons and join a gym. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was like that kind of mentality with the steps, you know? I'll just tell about my first step experience. I like talking about it. On page 152 here. Well, let me set this up a little bit. So I had been, at this certain time, I think I had, you know, in between 1 and 2 months sober. I was in a halfway house. I've been going to lots of AA meetings, 3 meetings every day, okay? Going to lots of AA meetings. I would go to the same meeting at noon, the same meeting at 5:30, and then at night I would go to, like, different meetings, you know? So I started to know lots of people in the Rochester area, or, you know, because I'm going out a lot, so I'm meeting a lot of people, and, like, I'm, like, putting on this front, you know, that everything's okay. Like, oh, Ryan, you got over a month now. How's it going? Great, fine, doing good, you know? And, like, I got the kind of personality that I can kind of, like, you know, put on that front, you know, I can be that actor. It comes pretty naturally to me, you know? So I remember this meeting very specifically. It was a gratitude meeting. I was, you know, like I say, maybe 40, 45 days sober, something like that. And it was a small meeting. There was 8 of us or 10 of us or whatever. And they, like, go around the circle. So everyone had to say what you're grateful for. One of those kind of deals. And I remember sitting there just thinking, oh God, Ryan, come up with something, you know, something you're grateful for. So it got to me and I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm so grateful. I got a roof over my head and clothes on my back and, like, pack of cigarettes or whatever it was, you know what I'm saying? Like, I came up with some stuff like that, right? And I go back to the halfway house and my roommate had just moved out. Well, the line on 152 here, he says, we know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday, he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And let me tell you, I went back to that halfway house, I locked the door, I had the room to myself, and I laid on the bunk and I just started crying, man. I was like, it was just a real empty, painful, hopeless place. It was like the first time I realized, now I knew I couldn't drink anymore. I knew I couldn't live with alcohol. It was very crystal clear. But it was the first time I really realized that, like, I can't live without it either. And there it felt like a trap I couldn't spring. It felt like I was totally cornered and I was totally boxed in. And, you know, I'd like to say from there, that's my sobriety date, and, like, everything was wonderful, you know, this beautiful spiritual awakening happened from there. Like, no, it wasn't like that. Like, I still drank some more, and, you know, like, but that was, like, the moment. That was, like, that I really experienced the first step. I didn't have a sponsor yet or anything. I didn't even really understand any of that kind of stuff, but that's the first time it really went in my heart, in my soul, that, like, of myself, I'm not going to beat this thing. It's not working, what I'm doing. It seemed like AA wasn't working, but, you know, I knew there was more. I knew people kept telling me to get a sponsor and work the steps, and I, you know, I kind of grudgingly went ahead and did that. You know, what's beautiful about our program, you know, if that is that hopelessness is the first step, you know, in a nutshell, it's really the problem. And it doesn't tell me, like, I can't ever drink anymore. It basically tells me I am going to drink again. You know, what's cool is, you know, with my sponsor, when I got to page 44, he just kind of asked these two questions, you know, these two simple questions. And now, you know, that's how we qualify people, you know, like, you know, when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely. Or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And I remember my sponsor asking me that. So my first sponsor took me through line by line from the title page all the way through. So it had been a while we had been meeting, you know, before we got to that point. I remember being kind of annoyed because I'm like, dude, couldn't you just ask me that in the first place? Like, we could have moved on, you know what I'm saying? but, you know, I was able to honestly say, yes, that is my case. That's how it goes for me. That's what it looks like for me, you know? And so, you know, if the first step is the problem, the second step really is the answer. You know, it tells us on 45 there, lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. Where and how are we to find this power? And, you know, that comes back to that first step experience, was truly believing and understanding deep down that I did not have the power in me to stay stopped, to stay not picking up that first drink one more time. And, you know, I needed power. I was not raised religious, at all. Like, we didn't go to church, nothing, you know, nothing like that. And I used to be intimidated in AA meetings because I would hear the word God quite a bit in AA meetings, you know? And I was like, man, I don't know anything about that. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I really thought that was going to hold me back from the steps, you know, because I'm like, I don't understand that. I don't know what that means, you know, whatever. I think in hindsight, it ended up being an asset for me because I didn't have these kind of, you know, prejudiced ideas that a lot of guys I work with seem to come in and have, you know, all these old ideas about religion. I didn't have any of that. You know, I was basically a blank slate. And, you know, it was so cool. Like, not my sponsor, but my sponsor's good friend talked about, he lived out in the country, and he talked about he would lay on his back at night out in the country, and he could look up at the stars and just say, you know, there's something out there. There must be something more than this, you know? And that was enough for me. That little bit was enough for me to say, yeah, there must be something more than that. Yeah, there's something more out there. The stars, you know, that's not human. And, you know, I know science can explain a lot of this stuff, but it was profound enough for me. And it might sound simple to a lot of people, but at the time I was at in my life, that was like, you know, it was profound enough for me to make that attempt. You know, what's so cool about AA is like, you know, if the staunch atheist is at a zero and the true believer is at 100, you know, we just need you to come over from 0 to 1. Like, that's it. You know what I'm saying? It's so open and roomy. And, you know, I just needed to see for myself that I didn't have the power and I needed another power, you know? And, you know, so we basically, you know, now that I understood the problem and I understood the answer, we got into the third step. And my sponsor, we read that stuff and how it works. We read that stuff 60 to 63, and I'm sure he like broke it down and explained it to me and stuff like that. But step three is so cool because it's like, you know, it could really be like 1,000 miles deep. You know, it's, I think initially it was simply like, here's the problem, here's the answer. Which one do you want? You can make a decision. And, you know, at that point I'm knee deep. I'm like, let's go, you know, let's do what we got to do, you know? But, I've since learned so much more about that kind of hard left turn Wilson takes when he gets to 60, you know, to page 60. Cause it's like all of a sudden, you know, we're talking all this stuff here, you know, a first requirement is we're convinced any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And from there on to the third step prayer, all of a sudden we're not talking about alcohol anymore. And it's almost like, you know, it's almost like a big bait and switch. You know, it's like we just learned all this stuff about alcoholism and now we're like, make this hard turn and we're not really talking about drinking anymore. And now we're starting to look at Ryan and we're starting to look at how life has gone for Ryan, drunk or sober, you know, how am I showing up, you know? And I always seemed like that alcohol was the problem. And up until that third step, I was really treating recovery like alcohol was the problem. Because it seemed to make sense. It seemed logical, you know? And we get to learn in these pages, this 60 to 63, we get to learn, like, man, the show usually doesn't come off very well. and, you know, and that goes for me, you know, sober today, by the way, you know. My default is, my default is self-centeredness. You know, 62 says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. That wasn't just when I was drinking. I mean, that is, you know, that is my default. That is how I show up. You know, without God, without Alcoholics Anonymous, without practicing these spiritual disciplines, you know, that's how I wake up in the morning, self in the center. And what's so beautiful about, you know, the initial process of going through the steps and, you know, how we continue to grow throughout our sobriety is like, you know, just by doing a few simple things, I can get self out of the center and get God or a power, spirit, whatever you want to say, into the center. And, you know, I'm just so grateful. The program is, It's just absolutely beautiful, and I love this stuff so much. You know, what's cool, what I always love, the line on 64 there, it says, our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. And, you know, again, this was cool initially, but this is cool today too. This never stops. We find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. And getting down to causes and conditions, you know, self, for me, shows up in all these kind of different ways, you know. And I gotta watch for that stuff. You know, I get to watch for that stuff, I'll say. Yeah, I don't want to go on. I don't have time to go on about, you know, all the steps and stuff like that. But it was, I did have a cool experience initially. And, you know, I was guilty of, I'm embarrassed to say it, but I was guilty of going a long time basically working the first step and the 12th step. My first sponsor really drove home every time the book would talk about carrying the message. You know, helping others. Anytime the book would mention that, he would really drive that home. So initially, I started sponsoring guys pretty early in sobriety. It was mostly out of fear. You know, like I finally felt a little taste of freedom. I wasn't obsessing about drinking anymore. I didn't want to lose that. So I was like fearful. So I would like go try to carry the message. But you know, what's so cool about that experience is what eventually happened to me. You know, life took on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. At some point, and I don't know when it is, the first handful of guys I sponsor, whatever, at some point, I turned from this fear-based sponsorship to a love-based sponsorship, because I was sitting there, you know, kneecap to kneecap with guys and watching the light come back on in their eyes. And it is just the most beautiful experience that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so cool to sit there and see this little broken guy in front of me. And, you know, we learn some about alcoholism and we take this a few simple steps and, you know, we write an inventory and we do a fifth step. You know, the most honorable thing I think we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is be the sponsor, be the other side of the table of the fifth step. It has changed my life profoundly. Every time I get to do it, it is an honor, because I get that feeling that I used to get that alcohol gave me in the very beginning, because it makes me feel connected to you, because I've had the privilege of sponsoring, you know, people from all these different walks of life, you know, black, white, young, old, gay, straight, all these different people. But when we look at the inventory and we get rid of that and we get done with column two, you know, we get to that fourth column stuff, like we're all the same. I mean, we all have these same little, the same few things, you know, just scared to death of what you think of me, needing your approval, all this, you know, just a few little simple things that we all seem to have deep down. And every time I get to experience that, it is absolutely beautiful. And I love seeing the light come on in these guys' eyes. And then even better than that is when I get to see them go out and have that experience also, go start sponsoring, go see the light come on in someone else's eyes. That was a cool history of the group that my man did at the beginning of the meeting. I loved how you said this group, something about like, we want to teach people to be sponsors, to be sponsors, to be sponsors. To me, I mean, I think that's what our program, I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is really all about. You know, we can get unblocked through steps 4 through 9, right? And you know, we can have this, our spirit can awaken, we can have a spiritual experience or, you know, our spiritual awakening. So that's cool. But it's like, man, you know, people that, I don't want to say it negative, some people, for whatever reason, don't sponsor, choose not to sponsor, whatever. And it's like, man, you're missing out on the good stuff. You're missing out on the good stuff. This is it. This is where it's at. And, you know, I think Wilson and these and our founders, they knew that. They spent a lot of time in our book explaining how to do that, how to make a 12-step call on the first visit, how to, you know, what do we do on the second visit, you know, how do we carry the message? And they say it all kinds of different ways throughout the whole book, you know, vital to permanent recovery, intensive work with other alcoholics, immunity from drinking. I mean, they really make it crystal clear that that's what we're supposed to be doing. And somehow it seems like, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole. Somehow it seems like, well, God's popped into my brain, so it's coming out. Somehow it seems like our fellowship has somehow put meetings in the middle of recovery. And please don't come at me. I love AA meetings. I really love AA meetings. I truly, genuinely enjoy, I love alcoholics. I mean, I'm all about it. But it seems like somewhere along the line, we put, as a fellowship, we put the actual meeting itself in the center of our recovery, where, you know, it seems like our original program had a few other things, you know, mostly God and helping others in the center of our recovery, you know, and, you know, I love going to AA meetings. I try to go to, you know, however many I can, you know, stuff like that. We have a busy life. You know, Reese and I, we got two kids. We got jobs and school and, you know, life's crazy. So I try to go to some AA meetings. But a lot of my AA time or recovery time is spent with 12-step work. You know, I think that's what our program's really telling us to do. Either get out there and try to carry the message, or be able to sit there, you know, eyeball to eyeball with a new guy, or, you know, show up at the wind-up joint, stuff like that, where we can talk and carry this message. So I do love AA meetings, so please don't come at me, anybody. you know, I've recently for me, the last couple years since we've joined this PPG book study that we're doing, I never came back to, I got ADHD, so I didn't come back to, I did the first step and a 12-step for like a decade, or maybe 12 years. Like, there was a long period of time, I'm embarrassed to say it, but it is my story. Like, I didn't write inventory, I didn't make amends. I used to say I was doing 10th and 11th step, but it was kind of like, you know, if something really major happened, I would ask God to remove it and call my sponsor. And, you know, my upon awakening was, you know, laughable. I refer to it now as like a bedside deal, you know, get out of bed, God, please keep me sober today. You know, and at night, God, thank you for keeping me sober today, that kind of stuff. And, you know, by studying the book, what's cool about the book studies is I really recognized how much of the actual program of Alcoholics Anonymous I was not doing. You know, we refer to steps 10, 11, and 12 as AA's relapse prevention plan, because, you know, the people that relapse, you know, and it happens all the time, you know, and I always ask the same few questions, you know, how often were you calling your sponsor with a 10th step? What did your retire at night look like? What did your upon awakening look like? Were you pausing when doubtful or agitated? And how many new guys were you working with? And the answer always is no, no, a little and none, you know, or whatever, you know, it's always the same. So it's like, you know, you can leave treatment and, you know, they can give you this relapse prevention plan, which probably has like a trigger list and some other stuff that I don't agree with. but we actually have our own, you know, relapse prevention plan, and actually working steps 10, 11, and 12, you know, on a daily basis, in and out. I think it's my job moving forward is actually living in those steps and doing those steps, you know. And what's cool about with step 10, you know, the word, I worked with this word for like a few weeks. I was just obsessed with this word watch, you know, because I always treated the 10th step as like this kind of reactionary thing where, like, you know, I'd be running on self and I'd step on someone's toes and then I would like have to call my sponsor and then go apologize for it, you know. But what's fascinating is using the word watch, I can kind of get ahead of this stuff. You know, I'm spiritually, you know, if my spirit is awakened with those 9-step promises, I'm spiritually awake. By the time we get into 10 and 11, we're being spiritually alert, okay? And I'm like able to watch my thinking some and see, you know, when I run on self. And, you know, one of the questions on the nightly is like, I forget how it says, Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? All right, if I'm honest, I've never been able to answer no to that question because I'm constantly thinking of myself. That's what it happens, you know? But I'm aware of that and I'm awake to that today. And we got some thing, you know, there's some cool things that I get to do to kind of get me out of that. Turn my thoughts to someone I could help. And it's just, it works. It really does. It's very simple. The actual 10-step process is such a simple spiritual exercise. You know, it can be done in, you know, 5 minutes, something like that, 10 minutes, something like that. It's very, very simple. You know, I'm watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear when they crop up, not if, but when they crop up as they do throughout life. You know, that gives us four things to do about it. You know, I ask God at once to remove them, talk to someone immediately. My first phone call is always to my sponsor. Sometimes he doesn't answer. I got some other guys I call. Make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone, and turn my thoughts to someone I could help. That's the one that tied me up on the 10th step for a long time. That's why I didn't bother with the 10th step for a long time, because I never read it like that. I read it like, go help someone. And I'm like, I'm at work. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm in the middle of my workday. I drive a truck. I can't just go park the truck and go down to the meeting house and find a guy in a halfway house to carry the message to. So I read it like that, so I didn't really bother doing what the 10 steps telling me to do. But it's only telling me to turn my thoughts to someone I could help. Now, that is a simple thing to do. And by turning my thoughts to someone I could help, I got lots of new guys in my life and guys that have been around that have all kinds of different issues and problems and stuff like that. I can just think, oh, how can I help so-and-so? Oh, maybe I'll shoot him a text, see how he's doing. Maybe I can reach out on the phone. Maybe I can, whatever it is, you know, oh, I'm meeting with so-and-so for step work tomorrow night. What's that going to look like? You know, should we read that line by line? Should we go through a little, you know what I mean? And I'm just by thinking of that stuff, all of a sudden, you know, that selfishness kind of vanishes. And it goes away, and I just love it. The other huge growth thing for me the last few years since studying this stuff is the when I retire at night. It's another word that I missed was retire. So I always read it as when you go to bed at night, you know, you do this stuff. So I never did a written inventory for probably, you know, 13 years. I don't know, a long time. I never did a written nightly inventory. But somebody pointed out to me, it says, when we retire at night. And what does retire really mean? It just means when I'm done working. You know, so basically dinner's done, get the dishes put away, we're sitting on the couch, might do a Zoom meeting, whatever it is, I'm retired for the night. You know, that's when I do my nightly inventory. I'm still awake enough, I'm not exhausted, you know what I mean? I don't need to, you know, fly through it. And I can take some time and really give a thoughtful consideration to the process. And, you know, what's cool about it is, you know, at the bottom of the sheet I use, it's just the questions right out of the book, but it asks about corrective measures. What corrective measures need to be taken? So I look at this as, you know, spiritual corrective measures. And they're often very similar, you know, quiet meditation. Like if I didn't do a quiet meditation that day, quiet meditation almost every day is more conscious contact, more deep breathing. Reach out to more alcoholics, more phone calls, stuff that kind of, that's the nature of it. The way I read for Upon Awakening, when it says, you know, we consider our plans for the day, I pull out my nightly inventory from the night before and I see those corrective measures. And I consider that my spiritual plans for the day. And man, how cool has that been? It's been awesome. You know, it's just been like, now it's helping me be aware and watching throughout the day. I don't want to have a bad nightly, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, I'm on top of it throughout the day. And you know, it's helped me grow quite a bit from that. I've already talked some about the 12th step. I will just say, you know, as I'm wrapping this up here, you know, something's happened to me in the last, I don't know, 6 months or 8 months or something like that, where I think I've lightened up some. I think I used to be real kind of rigid on, you know, our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through that, you know, I have not enjoyed a lot of the aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've kind of been able to, something's happened where I've been able to lighten up and just kind of show up at any old AA meeting and genuinely enjoy myself. You know, let people be where they are. I'm really not good at that. You know, let people be where they are. You know, Charlie Parker always used to say, I'm always ready to kill someone over something I just learned 30 minutes ago. It is so me. They're killing people over here. But I've been able to kind of, lighten up and really just show up at an AA meeting and genuinely ask God to speak through me and show up from a position of love and compassion and just try to be helpful and try to stay out of my own way a little bit, I guess. I wish I would have thought of it because in the history there, they read that line from the first page of There Is a Solution. It says, we're people who normally would not mix. There exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. And that is my current experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. Indescribably wonderful. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love everything AA. I really do. It's just where I'm at right now, you know. I went through this kind of bitter stage where, you know, everyone wasn't doing it right and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I'm just at more of a place of love and compassion. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I love alcoholics. I always say that. You know, I love drunk alcoholics and sober alcoholics. I married an alcoholic. And, I don't always love drinkers, I guess, but I alcoholics, man, I love it. I can't really, indescribably wonderful. I can't really use words to describe the gratitude. It even doesn't feel right saying it, but the gratitude that I have for Alcoholics Anonymous, for leading me to a power greater than myself that has just been so tremendously awesome. This life that we have today, we've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. That was cool. But now it's just like we get to live life. One day at a time, we get to live life. Yeah, it's indescribable. I can't really come up with words for it. My gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous is tremendous. That thing I read from 89 there, let me not get it wrong here with you guys. It says, frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And I find this to be my current experience. You know, it's so fun. I talk to a lot of AAs on the phone, through internet AA. I've met lots of people from all over the world, really. But I have some really good friends that are not in Rochester that I talk to, daily or a couple times a week. And it is the bright spot of my life. I just can't say enough about Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you again, Jeff. Thanks for asking me. And I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you, guys.